So that's the Moody Boys from 1990 with, guess what the title of that was? Anyway, welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Vladimir Putin, a big speech this week about World War II, which was delayed from the 1st of May due to the pandemic. And also the president of Burundi drops dead. Didn't hear about that one on the news after expelling the World Health Organization from his country. Also, Hong Kong banning satire. Actually, officially last weekend, no more satire and various jokes had to be taken off the air that were ready to go. Shows banned, sketches banned and all that sort of thing. Three Americans this week, though, throwing light onto the troubles of our day. First, Catherine Austin Fitz, who says the pandemic's being used to push a cashless society and a digital currency agenda, which is what the banksters want. Also challenging the myths, she's doing anyway, of Bill Gates is Microsoft's self-made man. She runs something called the Solari Project, which is advising investors as well as critiquing from a Christian point of view and a biblical point of view much of what's going on in the world today. Then former US Army officer Mike Sparks from Alabama. He looks at the pulling down of the Confederate Albert Pike's statue in Washington, D.C. last weekend, I suppose inspired by our very own glorious Colston puller downers, demonstrators. And what about his 1871, Pike that is, 1871 letter predicting three world wars? Supposed letter anyway, alleged letter, two of which have already taken place, just as Pike predicted. So what does the letter say exactly? And who is this guy, Nostradamus? That letter may be a forgery, like the Protocols of Zion, maybe. Then, did Churchill cut deals at the end of the war for the Nazi gold? The setting up of Hitler's treasurer, Martin Bormann, who escaped the Nuremberg gallows as one of the world's most powerful investment bankers. We hear from Peter Manning, the son of Paul Manning, author of Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, one of the greatest US journalists of the Second World War, who was booted out of the profession, basically put out to grass because he was pursuing what we in the journalistic trade call, hey, this is the wrong story, pursuing a Nazi war criminal. And also Paul's brother, Jerry, just after the book was published, was shot dead in cold blood, as well as the publisher, Lyle Stewart, having both of his legs broken. The Fourth Reich really didn't want that book published. That's how important this story is. And what does it mean today? We finish with that one. Today. But Martin, let's start with Putin, because it's been hardly reported at all, this speech by Putin. He really did a whole analysis of what went wrong with the Treaty of Versailles and the League of Nations. And he's saying, look, we've got to understand this if we want to prevent World War III.
Well, yeah, I mean, as you know, Putin is not given any sensible hearing in Western media. He's just regarded as a bogeyman. But the speech, I've seen extracts from it. It's basically giving the Russian version of World War II. And of course, you know, plenty of people basically underestimate what they did, but they basically won the war in Europe single-handed. And it's quite possible, of course, that they were saying at the end of the war that they were going to invade, they invaded Manchuria and they were about to invade Japan. And the all the fuss that was made about we had to drop the atomic bombs because there would have been a million casualties if the Americans and the British had tried to storm Japan. The Red Army was ready to storm Japan and they would have taken a million casualties. They'd already taken loads and loads and loads. Another million would just be another million. And they were ready to take Japan.
Yeah, given that the Russians
that's why they dropped bombs on them.
Given that the Russians lost about 20 times more soldiers dead and wounded in the Second World War than Britain and America combined, it's extraordinary, isn't it?
And loads of civilians, of course.
Well, yeah, as well. It's amazing, really, that they were fighting from 1941 right the way to the end. So that was really they were fighting for four times longer than we were.
Well, I mean, it's hard to quantify all of these things.
Well, no. The Russians would say that actually, in fact, I'm sure Stalin did say at the time when D-Day came, well, you left that a little bit late, didn't you?
Well, that's because if they didn't move at that stage, then the Soviet Union was going to take over the whole of Western Europe. And they, as you know, Tony, there's evidence to suggest that the Battle of Arnhem was fixed so that Bormann and others could escape. And, you know, the paranoia in Moscow that the West was intending to nuke them wasn't paranoia. Churchill said, "But let's Operation Unthinkable. Why don't we nuke them now before they get nuclear weapons?"
Well, I mean, back in a year after the Russians entered the war, well, after Operation Barbarossa, when the Nazis launched their attack on the Russians in 1941, a year later, Stalin had been banging his fists on the table saying, "Look, we're happy to fight this lot, but why don't you come over the channel and open a Western Front?" And they wouldn't, and they wouldn't. But on the 19th of August 1942, there was this raid on Dieppe. And actually, it was sabotaged by the British, as we now know, with John Ainsworth Davis going to Berlin as a double agent and telling the Nazis, well, in order to get into their confidence, this raid was coming. And so because the raid, which killed something like 3,000 Canadian soldiers, almost all Canadians died, the signal was sent to Stalin, well, we did try, but we didn't manage to do it. So that was quite a sneaky little maneuver, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. And of course, if you read John Ainsworth Davis' book, he was actually on the cliffs as the Canadians were coming into Dieppe, and basically the Germans had said, if they don't come in where you say they're coming in, we're going to shoot you. But in fact, they came, and he said it was the most sickening thing in his career as a spy, because he knew that basically those soldiers were sacrificed so that he could become a trusted agent as far as the Germans were concerned. And that's the level of subterfuge that was going on.
Interesting that they chose Canadians to make that raid rather than British soldiers, isn't it?
Well, the Canadians were being pushed by their own people back home. Can you do, you know, they wanted to be seen to be doing something. But they were pretty cynically sacrificed, basically.
Anyway, so Putin is talking about Versailles as being really sowing the seeds for World War II, the treaty after World War I. Is that correct, do you think?
I think that's pretty much the way most historians look at it. It's quite obvious that the Treaty of Versailles was totally one-sided. The real problem was that the British were willing to forgive reparations to the German reparations, provided that the Americans forgave the British for the debts that they'd got into. But one top politician in the US said, well, they hired the money, didn't they? So basically, they took the view that they'd paid for the war, but they wanted the money back. And in fact, Britain only paid back in 2015 the money that we'd borrowed to fight World War II from the Americans. And that really caused all the problems. If everybody had taken a more realistic attitude, then World War II could have probably been prevented. And of course, Keynes famously wrote The Economic Consequences of the Peace, because he was one of the negotiators at Versailles, and he said, if you try and bankrupt the Germans, that's not going to do them any good. It's not going to do you any good. What's the point of bankrupting them?
One of the terms that Putin's using throughout this talk is something called the Munich Betrayal. Well, we don't get it called that over here, do we? It's called the Munich Agreement, and it's where Chamberlain came back from Munich from an agreement with Hitler saying, oh, it's okay, we're going to have peace in our time. You know, that's was the attitude in Britain. Why would Putin see it as a betrayal?
It was a crucial moment, because they were trying to build an alliance to stop Hitler. And both Poland and Britain agreed that Hitler could move into the Sudetenland. And at that point, the communists decided, Stalin decided, that it made sense for him to do a deal with Hitler, because what was happening was that the Western powers were lining Hitler up to invade Russia. And so he thought he was going to be...
Well, no, Czechoslovakia, not Russia.
No, ultimately Russia, yeah? That's when Stalin, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact happened after Munich, because before Munich there had been discussions. I mean, the Czechs were ready to fight, and the Red Army said, "Well, we'll come into Czechoslovakia and fight beside you." But the British decided to appease Hitler, and at that point Stalin switched sides. Foolishly, he was totally taken in by Hitler. He didn't believe when Barbarossa took place and the surprise attack on Russia, Stalin was stunned, because he didn't really think that he'd basically been completely fooled by Hitler. But you can see the justification in Russian eyes for that Molotov-Ribbentrop pact was that we were ready to fight over Czechoslovakia, and you decided to back down, so we're going to make our own arrangements with Hitler.
One of the Canadian academics has said that the Cold War started after 1917, or in other words, he was talking really about the Treaty of Versailles setting the scene for all of the things that happened right the way up to the Cold War.
Well, yeah, I mean, everything's connected to everything else in a long chain of events, isn't it? I mean, we're still living with the consequences of the First World War.
He also says that the Western elite actually rather liked Hitler. In fact, of course, as we know, even our own king was very pro-Nazi, Edward VIII, and maybe others who weren't prepared to say it openly. The Western elite saw Nazi Germany as a bulwark against the Soviet Union and Bolshevism.
Yeah, I mean, basically, what they were plotting to do was they were allowing Hitler to come to power with all sorts of help and support. Prescott Bush, for example, George W. Bush's grandfather, was very heavily involved in investing in German war industry. And the idea was that they would basically deal with the Soviet Union for them. But it didn't work out exactly as they planned.
So anyway, done a little bit there, I hope, to look at this fascinating bit of history, which has been covered very, very much in Russia. A lot of Russians finding this interesting, having the history. And he's basically saying, I suppose the way to round off our discussion about Putin's speech this week, Martin, is he's saying that the Russians are a very stoic people and that they will perform very well if it's a crisis or a disaster. And he's really hinting that there may well be one coming down the road, either economic or war.
Well, the Russian general staff are preparing for war. There's no doubt about it. They've lost all delusions about the West. They realize it doesn't matter who wins the US presidential election. They're in for the long haul, but they're not reckless, and they don't want to fight, but they're definitely preparing to do so, as are the Chinese.
Okay, well, we haven't really talked much about the virus this week, but we'll be doing that in a minute by hearing the views of Catherine Austin Fitz on it. But Martin, we've seen this amazing amazing events this week with the death of this guy from Burundi, the president, just dropping dead after he expels the World Health Organization. There seems to be actually quite a lot of resistance within Africa to the programs of the World Health Organization, although they seem to be being generally embraced in Britain and America and the developed world. The African countries don't like it seems. In many cases, the resistance has come from there, as you pointed out a few weeks ago, with the bribe being paid, I think it was in Nigeria, wasn't it, in order to get a mandatory vaccination bill through.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't picked up on the fact that the president of Burundi had died or that he'd kicked the WHO out. But the WHO is an extremely flawed organisation, as we know. It ought to be a public sector body to coordinate world health, but it is, in fact, captured by the pharmaceutical companies and people like Bill Gates. I mean, why Bill Gates is the biggest contributor to it now that the US has withdrawn from it. And, of course, you know, something like the WHO probably has to exist. I was reading about what's going on in terms of building a vaccine, and the pharmaceutical companies are basically taking loads of lolly from the governments to develop vaccines, which they will then control the patents on. And that's the real issue. But these things shouldn't really be done in the private sector at all. Health issues are so important and so far-reaching for the whole of humanity. I mean, if this pandemic or another pandemic comes out of the third world, it's going to kill everybody in the first world as well. Health is a holistic thing. You can't just have a – I mean, of course, and the whole model of healthcare in the US has been shown to be completely bust, where millions of people have no healthcare, even one of the richest countries in the world. And, of course, things like a pandemic just expose the whole fallacy that you can somehow ensure private insurance can insure you against things like this. The answer is it can't anymore.
I'm just looking at the fortruss.com. That's fort-russ.com's Africa section. I mean, none of this stuff is really being reported. I would have thought that almost every one of these stories would be a big deal for Black Lives Matter. Maybe they just haven't read this, but the World Bank apparently are using COVID-19 to further indebt the whole of Africa, pushing what they say, use the word debt slavery in Africa. It's what quite clear that Africa is plunging down into ever more debt and poverty over the last 2 or 3 months, the biggest increase in both that's ever been seen in Africa. And there are all sorts of, I mean, the main one really being the death of this Burundian president. I'll try and pronounce his name. Nkurunziza. Dying suddenly after expelling World Health Organization for what he calls a false pandemic. Now, the funny thing is here that our own National Health Service actually deregistered about a week or two after the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 to be a pandemic. Our own National Health Service actually degraded it down from being a pandemic very quickly. So in a way, they are doing it quietly, but he was doing it very vocally. The president of Burundi, Pierre Nkurunziza, 55, died following a heart attack. The sudden death comes as a surprise, as he'd been evaluated recently as being in overall very good health. But controversy has emerged in the African country as local pundits suggested his death was the consequence of poisoning. Less than a month ago, a Burundian government ordered the expulsion of all experts from the World Health Organization responsible for advising on the false pandemic, they call it, COVID-19. The president of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs declared the World Health Organization representatives were persona non grata on Burundian territory. For information to date, and despite its opposition to the World Health Organization, Burundi officially declared only one COVID death. Well, that's a little bit far-fetched compared against 30,000 dead in France. So it seems that this guy was to a certain extent in denial about this virus, Martin, but very strange that he should just fall over dead, isn't it?
Well, it is, but you can't presume anything until you've investigated thoroughly. It reminds me a bit about Thabo Mbeki in South Africa, who claimed that HIV didn't cause AIDS. In defiance of scientific opinion. And in some countries, they really don't want to think about COVID-19 because they haven't got any resources. Even if you knew that it's ripping through the population, what can you do? You haven't got the resources to deal with it.
I suppose you have to treat it as just, say, some sort of ordinary, like annual flu or something.
Well, I mean, the problem is in many parts of the world. I mean, Latin America is obviously in a very bad way, with Bolsonaro in Brazil basically in denial about the existence of the virus, even as they've got mass graves in Manaus in the Amazon.
Okay, let's just move over to look briefly at Hong Kong because we were talking last week, weren't we, about Fawlty Towers and the complete failure there. She's come back again, but the idea that you're not allowed to have satire, that if anyone mentions anything to do, say for example, with racism, that's got to be assumed to be racist rather than satirizing racism. It's now sedition satire in Hong Kong. A broadcaster we see last weekend cuts short a political satire show's 31 years. Agence France Press is reporting that. Cartoonists and journalists say self-censorship has already begun, blunting critical voices as fears crescendo over China's plan to impose sweeping anti-subversion laws in the restless city. For a man whose career has revolved around making people laugh, Nung Chi Sum had little to smile about last Friday. Huddled around a TV in a darkened studio, the comedian and a handful of colleagues watched the final episode of their satirical news show, Headliner, go live. The programme came to a close after a rebuke from regulators over a recent episode lampooning the police that prompted public broadcaster to end its 31-year run. What they're doing is just sending the police up, Martin, and that's it. That's now sedition in Hong Kong.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is an ongoing struggle between, the geopolitical needs of the government in Beijing and, the aspirations of people in Hong Kong. Incidentally, this week, Trump said if you burn an American flag, you can be sent to prison for 10 years. Not much satire there, eh?
Well, that sounds very un-American. Trump, in many ways, is very un-American. Anyway, look, let's have a listen now to Catherine Austin Fitz. Here she has some things to say about what she is thinking, that there are actually some links to 5G, but not between the virus and 5G, but not in the same way. She's basically saying, well, 5G is bad for your health, but also, obviously, the coronavirus is too. Don't get the two confused, but they're both separate. Anyway, let's have a listen to Catherine Austin Fitz now.
Now, I want to talk about the second wave. So the second wave is supposedly going to come in September. But here's what's going to happen in September. Because if you go back, and in fact, I think he lives in North Carolina. There's one of the best authors who's written about the history of vaccinations is Forrest Moretti. And he has a series of books, and he does a masterful job of explaining the game of what I just did a review for a book called Virus Mania. But let's say, Greg, that you spray pesticides on the farms for agricultural, you know, and it makes everybody sick. If you admit that, then of course you have big liability. The insurance companies lose a lot of money. No good. So instead, you blame a virus, and then you invent a vaccination for the virus, and you give everybody the vaccination. And instead of losing money on the liability, you make money, and you attribute the, you know, you stop using the pesticide, and you attribute everybody getting well to the vaccination, which isn't true. They stop getting sick because you stop using the pesticide. Okay, so it's an old game, and it's designed to manage your liabilities. Now, why are they saying there's going to be a second wave? Do you know what's going to happen in September, October? They're going to finish getting all the Starlight or Starlink satellites up, and they're going to start turning 5G on, and they're turning it on all over the country. And that's going to, if you look at the history of radically increasing EMF radiation, sort of messing with human electromagnetic fields, that's going to make a lot of people sick, just like the vaccinations or the injections. I won't call them vaccinations because they're not medicine. The injections are going to make people sick, and the 5G is going to make people sick. And they need a cover story because they need, for their plans of rolling out digital currencies and rolling out lots of robotics, they need 5G. 5G was invented by the Israelis for crowd control. It's a crowd control technology. It's not really a telecommunications technology. But if you look at all their plans, whether it's driverless cars or digital credit systems to replace the dollar, they need massive bandwidth. And, of course, they know it's going to make a lot of people sick. So it wouldn't surprise me if the second wave is the cover story for all the extraordinary damage that's going to be done to our health by the injections. And if you look at the numbers, it's clear that the people who had this year's flu shot were much more likely to get COVID-19 and to suffer from it or die from it.
So that's Catherine Austin Fitz there, echoing what we were saying, that Dolores Cahill from Ireland was saying, which is that the flu vaccine can actually quite enormously increase your vulnerability to COVID-19. Well, it's not the sort of thing that's very intuitive. You wouldn't think it had very much to do with it. It should surely protect you. But what this US Army study has shown is most clearly that it can make you far more vulnerable to COVID-19 after you've had a flu vaccine. And you won't hear that and see that on the TV and the mainstream media because it's really not part of the right story. But anyway, Martin, what she's saying there is really to do with a second wave possibly being caused by other things. Anyway, look, rather than just comment on that, let's go to another a couple of clips from Catherine Austin Fitz, and be nice to get your comments once we've heard them all. Here she is talking about the Bill Gates business model, which I found quite interesting, in that he kind of puts himself forward, and Microsoft is this amazing company that just did really well. Well, actually, she paints a very different picture here.
We've literally created a database I call Creepy Technology, and there's what we know they can do now and where I think they're going. So I'm very clear that where I think they're going is trying to do a Microsoft Office system in your body. So Bill Gates' business model was he throws a Microsoft operating system in your computer. It has a back door. His business model is giving people access to all your data and your privacy, and you inundate the world with viruses so you can regularly update that.
Right. Yes.
And if you look at many of the things that have gone on to compromise the financial system and financial fraud, they couldn't have gone on with all those backdoors. Now, Microsoft was far from the only one. So I see Bill Gates and Microsoft as being a proprietary. Now, do you know what I mean when I say proprietary?
No. Okay. What specifically?
Proprietary. In Washington, a proprietary was a business that looked like a private business but was totally beholden to the intelligence agencies. And so, you know, you would sit down and have a meeting with the CEO, would make a deal. You thought everything was fine, and then suddenly the deal would get unraveled. And it wasn't his board. It was, you know, Langley. In other words, his entire financial model depended on government contracts, government subsidy, government this, government that. And literally the intelligence agencies, they thought they owned and governed the company. So you get these weird situations where you have a board of directors that think they run the company, investors who think they run the company, intelligence agencies who think they run the company, and then a CEO who's just navigating between them. And it gets very bizarre because companies behave in what you and I would think of as highly non-economic ways. But that's because their business model is not the model in the annual report. Their business model is, you know, providing a backdoor to America for the NSA and the CIA.
Catherine Austin fits again there, Martin. I think fascinating analysis, really, saying that, well, several things, really, but one of the most fascinating is that there's at least four different strands of people who think they run Microsoft. Actually, none of them really do, or maybe one does and maybe one another one does. The investors in it, the chief executive and the executive board, then you'd have the board of directors, and then also the intelligence services all grappling for control of a big company like Microsoft.
Well, I think the whole setup was set up by the military in the first place. The internet is basically their creature. And of course, the intelligence services always saw it as a means of spying on the population. And Bill Gates, of course, was basically given the job of pretending to be the guy in charge of it for them.
Yeah, so IBM had been developing a lot of this technology and the NSA, and they didn't really want it to be rolled out as their, you know, a government thing or an IBM thing. So Bill Gates got the job of saying, well, you know, you're going to be the operating system man. Microsoft is going to be your baby and you're going to front it. But it is, I mean, surely this is just really a front for the intelligence services, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, you know, the US economy is supposedly a free market economy, but in practice, most of the leading sectors are military industrial complex, which is basically government money. Now, of course, we mentioned Kinetic earlier. I mean, that's what's happened in this country. But we used to have a government-owned weapons industry. They've still got a government-owned weapons industry in Russia. But, of course, what we've got here is private industry making profits out of what are essentially government.
I mean, isn't it natural, though, that everybody is going to be what we might call rent-seeking? They'll see areas where they can make a lot of money without really having to do much. Especially when they see government programs, they'll say, well, it would be nice to turn that into a little private company. That'll be a nest egg for me and my kids forevermore.
Well, that's right. And, the way the capitalism actually functions compared to the very, you know, the fairy stories about what goes on, you know, these guys invent stuff in their garages and suddenly they become super wealthy and we're all supposed to look up to them for being so super intelligent and to be able to do all of this. It's just basically a fairy story. The government, particularly in the US, is the dominant force in the economy, although it's the pretense is otherwise.
And what about this back door? Because they're saying, what they're saying there is that it basically allows the government, and I would imagine their favoured corporations, to do data mining throughout the whole of the Microsoft system, because they've provided these little back doors. The idea is that Microsoft get this contract so long as they don't mention the access that the intelligence services have to all of your personal data that's on your computer or anywhere near it.
Well, it's a symbiotic relationship, isn't it? Bill Gates gets to make loads of money and the intelligence services get to spy on everybody. What's not to like?
Well, that's certainly the way it certainly does seem. Alternatives? Well, there are alternatives. There is Linux, you know.
Well, that's right. I mean, you'll find, is it Red Hat they use in China? And the intelligence services in West Germany won't use Microsoft because it's just compromised.
Well, they know, but the question is, do we? Anyway, that's Catherine Austin Fitz. I mean, she does a very good job, I think, on and well worth tracking down some of her work at Solari. I think it's .com. I'm not sure. But anyway, I'll put a link up to her on our show page. Next down the list to look at is Mike Sparks. And I contacted Mike. He lives down in Alabama, and he's a former military officer in the U.S. Army. And I asked him because he's a bit of a historian. He likes his Confederate history and his Union history. He's very good on the American Civil War. So I thought I'd ask him, who is this guy, Albert Pike, whose statue was torn down last weekend in Washington, D.C., although we didn't get very much coverage of it. It turns out that Albert Pike is actually quite an important, powerful character in U.S. history, mainly because he was Grand Master of the Scottish Rite of Freemasons in the U.S. at the time. So that means, well, he may have been a captain originally and then he became a general in the Confederate Army, but actually within the Masonic system he was the boss, you know, so he was really in charge of, say, you know, the political masters who were supposedly directing the Confederate War. So I asked Mike Sparks all about Albert Pike. Who is this guy that his statue was pulled down?
He was a captain early in the Mexican War, but he became a general, you know, once the big shindig began between North and South here in the United States. He obviously had military expertise to lead bigger groups of men than just a company. And he was a cavalryman, you know, riding and fighting from horses. As a big man, he was like 6 feet tall and 300 pounds. I'd feel sorry for the horse. He was a lawyer, right, so he had a legal mind, a very intelligent legal mind, and he helped the Indians, believe it or not, in their cases against the U.S. government. So he had a streak of anti-authoritarianism running throughout. Even when he was in the Army, he was in constant trouble with his superiors, and when he went into private law practice, he was taking on the Indians, you know, cases against the U.S. government, you know, obviously grabbing land continually. So he has some kind of social justice in him. You know, he's not somebody, you know, I'm going to lose sleep over because the statue got pulled down and defaced because he's considered to be an evil man because he was a, you know, Mason doing all that dirty trick secret society stuff. But, you know, you want to say some good things when he did good things. You know, representing the Indians was a unselfish good thing that he did. He just, unfortunately, after that, went into serious religious thought to further his Masonic secret society, which, you know, is diametrically opposed to good by its very nature. Use the example, if you had a house, I had a house, and three other people had a house, and we all decided we're going to get together, and we're going to pay off your loan, you know, your mortgage this year, and the next year you're going to pay off my mortgage, and then Jill's, and Jim's, and in 5 years, everybody's mortgage is paid off, and they own their home. Guess what? That's not allowed, because you're pretending to be a bank. That's what secret societies do. They work behind the scenes to use these networking efficiencies. They're allowed to do it. Of course, you and I are not allowed to do it. I sent you a memo of the FBI showing that they had a guy in the American Legion fronting for them on the grand jury of Jim Garrison, you know, DA of New Orleans, prosecution of Clay Shaw. Yeah. He reassured the FBI, don't worry, I'm the foreman of the grand jury. I'm going to make sure only American Legion people are appointed to the grand jury, and we're going to make sure that Garrison's investigation goes nowhere. We're not going to badmouth the FBI. See what I mean? The FBI is totally permeated by the Masons and a lot of law enforcement. So if the black hedonists had done their homework and protesting correctly, they would be protesting the right things about law enforcement, which is there's too much Masonic control and influence of law enforcement. But instead, they just do the skin color thing.
So that's Mike Sparks. Martin, what he's saying there effectively is that this Freemasonic thing is permeating in the US, permeating the justice system. He's given an example there as he's saying that the district attorney is trying to prosecute Clay Shaw, Jim Garrison from New Orleans, after the Kennedy assassination. Actually, it turned out that the jury had been fixed. And I mean, this isn't necessarily a Masonic thing, but it's through the Legion, the American Legion, which is often associated with Freemasons. So it does make you wonder, doesn't it, just to what extent these secret societies, how powerful they are, particularly when someone like Albert Pike, you know, he's obviously quite a powerful figure. Many people didn't even know he was a senior Freemason.
Well, obviously, the two different eras. I mean, Pike was around in the 19th century. JFK was assassinated in the 1960s. But the power of secret societies is clear. I mean, that's how elites operate. You know, we can probably make a list of them. The people who listen to this show will be very well aware of things like Skull and Bones, Bilderberg Group, Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, and there's probably all sorts of groups out there which we don't even know about, which are basically networking criminal elites to do their criminal thing.
It's well worth looking at this letter. And, you know, this letter of Albert Pike, I mean, if you look at it, you can see, actually, it may well not be true. It may be he didn't write this. It may be the whole thing has been fabricated. I mean, the fact that it mentions the Nazis, I mean, you'd have to be quite an amazing, like, Nostradamus character in order to get that into his letter. But Mazzini was a revolutionary leader in the mid-1800s. And he was over in Italy, really uniting Italy in a similar way that actually happened in America during the Civil War, with Pike being one of the senior people on the Confederate side and the military angle. And so the First World War, they said, must be brought about in order to permit the Illuminati to overthrow the power of the Tsars of Russia. Now, I mean, all these things in this letter, I won't go into it in that much detail. I'll put a link up on our show page. All these things actually did happen. The point being, though, that if you wanted to discredit a particular theory about Pike or about what was happening in world events, it would be quite simple. And I think this happened with the Protocols of Zion. What you do is you fabricate a document which actually does tell you what's going on, but you include in it several complete nonsenses and forgeries, so that if anybody picks it up and says, oh, this is true, then it's easy to discredit them. What do you think of that possible theory about the protocols and this letter of Albert Pike to Mazzini?
Well, the first point I'd make is people can predict the future, not by having any psychic powers or by pulling strings in secret societies. It's because the general thrust of what's going to happen is quite clear. I mean, I think we can confidently predict, as we're talking here now, that there will be some kind of World War III. We're already in it. And you don't really need any psychic powers to see it. It's in your face. It's been going on for ages. And I think the Protocols of the Elders of Zion was written originally by the Okhrana, which is the Russian secret service, as a means of whipping up anti-Jewish sentiment, which they then manipulated to keep the masses in Russia in subservience. And, you know, I don't really believe, I'm afraid, Tony, that the secret societies control events. They exist and they try to control
events. Don't put words in my mouth. I don't think they control events either. I think they have a great deal of influence over people in particularly in senior positions. But, you know, actually controlling the world is surely a rather more like herding cats, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, anybody knows that, Mike Tyson said, everybody's got a plan until you get smashed in the mouth.
Yes. You know, the Third World War. Anyway, you just talked about the Third World War. I think it's very well worth looking at this letter and the understanding that the letter itself may be a forgery, but what it's saying may well be true. So he's saying there that the Third World War must be fomented by taking advantage of the differences caused by the agents of the Illuminati between the political Zionists and the leaders of the Islamic world. Well, this is what we're seeing. And in fact, he's there saying that the political Zionists, he's really talking there about the Zionist lobby in Israel and the Christian Zionists and the Zionist lobby abroad outside Israel. They're the political Zionists and the leaders of the Islamic world. Well, they're really talking about people like Nasrallah and the Iranians, surely.
Well, I find this rather bemusing, because nobody ever used the term Zionist before it was coined by Theodor Herzl in the 1890s. And by that stage, I think Pike was dead. So he certainly couldn't have called anything Zionist, because it didn't exist in that era.
Well, possibly. I think it may have gone earlier than that. But anyway, But the whole point here really is that, I mean, this letter may even have been written, you know, say in the early 1900s, or, you know, say 1905 or something. The idea really being to say, to try and discredit the plan by issuing a document which is correct and it shows the plan, but it's a forgery. So this is what I'm saying, I suppose, comparing it to the Protocols of Zion. But anyway, let's have a listen now to what Mike Sparks has to say about the Pike letter. See if he agrees with you or not.
I don't think that the letter's legit. It was originally a 19th century hoax by a guy named Tackville. And then in 1958, a guy named Carr embellished it with words that couldn't possibly have been known in the 1870s, like Nazism and fascism is in the letter that's, you know, being spread around. But you don't need that letter from Albert Pike to know that the Illuminati have been instigating wars. With the turn of the century industrial age, the Rothschilds acquired billions of dollars of money from the production of widgets that we didn't have before. Before, wealth was generated generally by agrarian farming. But mass production of widgets has put billions of dollars in power into the hands of the Illuminati.
Martin, what he's saying there is really that there's an enormous amount of money been made by the banksters. He mentions the Rothschilds there particularly, due to industrialization, and that this has made really put a tremendous amount more power in their hands than they ever had before.
Well, who can deny that the financial power in the world is overweening and dominant? It's been going on for a long time, and it's coming to its apotheosis pretty soon, quite possibly. The banking system is going to collapse for good.
And it won't be just collapsing, will it? Because there's the Great Reset. Prince Charles is talking about this. The Bank for International Settlements is talking about it. Everyone's saying that we're going to have this reset. So they're obviously prepared something to take over from it all. Catherine Austin Fitz, in another interview I was listening to this week from her, says that it's going to be basically a kind of digital credit system whereby you don't actually have anything of value. The banking system just keeps a record of how much money you've got, and you can spend it or not spend it, depending on whether you have it. And she points out the problem with that is that you can have your wealth just turned on and off at the flick of a switch.
Well, that may be so, particularly in the more technologically advanced parts of the planet. But I don't see that happening very much in rural India, for example. Modi tried to get rid of cash because he was being put under pressure by USAID. Absolutely bonkers. I mean, a country like India, where most people, the large proportion of the population, haven't got any bank accounts. They really do need cash. And I can't see how they're going to get that round that.
Okay, well, let's listen now to Mike Sparks on COVID-19, see what he's got to say about that.
The general question about the virus would be, do you think the Illuminati instigated it or not?
Do you think it's man-made or not?
Answer to that one, I think, is yes. Nation states have weapons labs, and they do biological warfare research. It's just a matter of time before they're going to want to use that research in an actual operation. You know, it's like if you've got a rubber ducky and you never take a bath, one of these days you're going to say, I need to take a bath and play with my rubber ducky. So you've got this thing wagging the tail of the dog. So if it was a Chinese weapon lab, an American weapon lab, one of them is guilty, or both, because, you know, the virus is new.
Martin, he's pretty convinced that it's man-made.
I tend to that view myself, but I don't think you can be certain about these things, and you've got to keep an open mind. But what makes me, I think, is incredibly suspicious was the fact that they had pig flu in China, then bird flu, then this. And we know that the US has biological warfare capability at Fort Detrick. And incidentally, the DARPA, which is it's mind-boggling to think, but DARPA, which is the weapons, you know, a military part of the Pentagon, had investments in the Wuhan laboratory experimenting with bat coronaviruses. And of course, they were also experimenting with bat coronaviruses from China inside the US. Now, the collapse of the financial services sector in September was followed by a warning to the Israeli Defense Forces by the Defense Intelligence Agency in the US about a pandemic coming from China in November, as we know from ABC News and from the Times of Israel, who obviously spoke to the IDF. Now, all of these circumstantial evidences suggest that this is a biological warfare attack, A, to try and mess up the Chinese before they really overtake the US, because that's where that's going. Don't forget, there's an ongoing trade war going on, and trade wars are wars. You know, people die in them when the sanctions are placed on them, and so on. It makes it very, very difficult for people to function. And they're quite happy to have it blow back over the US for two reasons. They've got an excuse to bail the banks out. They've been bailed out even more humongously than they were in 2008, and hardly a whisper has been said about it, which in normal circumstances there would have been a hurricane of criticism. And, of course, the deep state in the US doesn't like Trump much anyway, so he certainly won't have been involved in it. So they've left him hanging in the wind. Because, you know, they've got these, you know, the deep state is now preparing probably for a Biden presidency, which will involve a confrontation with China and Russia. There's nobody you can vote for in the US who's not going to be pushing for war. It's bonkers.
Okay, so censorship. I mean, just to say that when we were recording Mike Sparks there, he's chatting away to us happily. As soon as we just about to start to record, suddenly communication is completely dead, and we've had this before several times with particularly people who are connected to transhumanism and ex-military people in the US. It's almost as if it's very difficult to prove, but it did seem as if we were being cut off in the middle of the interview, so I had to do that not such good quality one on the phone literally afterwards. So there's that censorship. There's also, Martin, the censorship of that story you just said, and when we put that program up on YouTube just pulled it down straight away. I think this is the one about the warning that the Israelis gave.
To the Israelis by the Defense Intelligence Agency.
This is the Defense Intelligence Agency warning the Israelis about a pandemic last November, and that is, I mean, not been reported hardly at all, has it?
No, and it's of great importance. The implication has to be that they knew it was going to happen before it happened, which implies that they may have some agency in creating it. And it's been reported in the Times of Israel. So if you're listening, Keir Starmer, that's not an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. It's in the Times of Israel, paper of record in Israel. The Defense and IDF in Israel were warned by the DIA of a pandemic coming from China in November, before the Chinese knew about it. This all suggests that there is a war being planned, and probably the Israeli intelligence services are in on all of this. And is that an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory? I don't care what they say. We're talking about military intelligence analysis here, and you can be quite sure that the Russians, the Chinese and the Iranians will have their analysts looking at all of this and making their minds up about where they're going to strike back, if they have to strike back.
Talking of censorship and propaganda, Wikipedia has become a bulletin board for corporate and imperial interests under the watch of its Randian founder, Jimmy Wales, and the veteran US regime change operative who heads the Wikimedia Foundation Catherine Miller. And this is on the Grey Zone. So Ayn Rand, loving founder. So the guy, Jimmy Wales, who founded it, is a big fan of Ayn Rand. Should we be concerned about that?
Well, I mean, it's basically right-wing libertarian stuff, isn't it? You know, and of course, Wikipedia and Facebook and Twitter, they are part of psychological warfare operations by the US state. And, you know, they just are. I can't see how anybody can deny it.
Well, that's right. A lot of the editing that goes on there, as Craig Murray pointed out, is done by one single person. And it's basically, as soon as the truth starts to appear on a Wikipedia page, this person appears and starts editing it out again.
So I've forgotten what the name of the guy is, but he's working round the clock, basically all day, 24 hours a day, editing Wikipedia. And what he's doing, this whoever it is, this bot, is slagging off people critical of the establishment and building up people like Elliot Higgins and Bellingcat, who are in bed with the establishment.
So now, I mean, I can remember this sort of thing, Martin,
to bend people's minds.
Way back in the noughties when we were doing the campaigning around the 7/7 London bombings and pointing out, for example, Benjamin Netanyahu's presence in London, the fact that he got a warning from his embassy, even though it was a surprise attack, and the fact that there were individuals. I can remember being spoken to by the people running various events saying that there was a character, I think it was called Rachel North, and it wasn't her real name because North's was supposed to be North London, that was appearing at several websites at the same time editing things. So basically it's one account being used by lots of people in order to, and this may be what's going on at Wikipedia. So there's a lot of scope for abuse, isn't there, of social media by whoever, by private interests, anyone with money who can pay somebody, or possibly even using artificial intelligence to put up messages, to spoil conversations, to obliterate facts, that sort of thing.
Well, WikiLeaks, one of the most significant things that they exposed was all of these cyber tactics, which are used by intelligence services and people like GCHQ. So, you know, they're basically involved in all sorts of skullduggery online. And we've got Brigade 77, which has got 1,000 members, we understand, all of whom are officers. And they spend all day, every day, online making stuff up and dissing people and bending the narrative by which people understand the reality that they're in. And what's it Karl Rove said a long time ago, you know, the advisor to Bush, he said, you people are in the reality-based community, and we're an empire now, and we're going to make things happen, and you're just going to respond to them. We can create our own reality. And, of course, that is exactly what they've been pushing for. I think one of the former head of the CIA, I've forgotten who he was, said, we will know that we have succeeded when everything that Americans believe about what's going on in the world has been fed to them by us.
Well, they're getting quite close to that through things like Operation Mockingbird. Anyway, look, let's have a, before we go to hear Peter Manning talking about his father, Paul Manning, let's have just a last little look at some of the events around the pandemic. Göttingen in Germany, a whole massive housing block has been quarantined, and there's been running fights and battles with police there. This is a really not a very good way, it seems to me, Martin. I don't know what you think, but to quarantine people by basically putting fencing all around their housing estate and blocking a whole load of residents in there so they can't get out. I mean, we did have the experience, didn't we, with the cruise ships at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, where it turned out that the people who were on the cruise ships were more likely to catch COVID-19 and die because they were being kept on there and there was no facilities for them on the outside. It seems like the same sort of thing is going on right now in Germany.
Well, I was reading earlier about what's happening north of Naples, where Bulgarian guest workers have been sealed into their apartment block, several hundred of them. They've been sealed in by the army because they've got 50 cases of COVID in there. But very reprehensibly, mobs of Italians are throwing stones at them and generally being hostile towards them. I mean, this as time goes on, tempers are fraying. Some countries have done reasonably well in controlling what's going on. Others have been absolutely hopeless, in which we can include our own. And the consequences of this are going to carry on spiraling out of control where they've lost control.
I mean, yeah, but it's surely, you know, just from a medical point of view, how can it possibly make sense when there is an area of concentration of coronavirus to just simply say, oh, well, we're going to give up on these people. Let's just let them all catch it and they're not going to be allowed out.
Well, what they did in China was they basically, when they found people had got coronavirus, they were taken away to secure medical facilities where they were isolated. And they managed to do quite a good job of doing that. And they've had, what is it, not quite 4,000 deaths in the whole of China. We've got 60,000 plus. I think we can see who's got it right and who's got it wrong, can't we?
Yeah, well, so why on earth? I mean, it always seems to be happening to these migrant workers and ethnic minority communities in Germany, particularly. And you're talking about that in Italy too. It seems to
it's the sort of thing that happened during the Black Death, isn't it? You know, one of the things that happened as the Black Death went across Europe is the people went out and massacred the Jews because they thought that they were responsible for it. That people aren't always rational, are they?
Well, the police surely have to be. They're not in a position where, you know, I just cannot get my head around why it could make any medical sense whatsoever. It seems to me to be much more like a sort of flexing the muscles of a police state than doing something which is medically sensitive.
What it's doing is saying, you lot stay over there and we don't care how many of you get it as long as you don't infect us. And this kind of thing is totally wrong.
But surely these racist type actions by the police are surely going to backfire.
Well, I mean, we are seeing the norms of civilized life being trashed on every front, aren't we? Look at, you know, the looting in the banking system, the provocations like the assassination of Soleimani, hatred and hostility to the other, whoever the other is. It's you know, it's not a pretty sight, is it?
And then we had a couple of nights ago in Brixton, a street party broken up by the police. The same last night in Notting Hill and between Mitcham and Streatham in London, another street party broken up by the police. And yet when it comes to certain events, such as protests by Black Lives Matter, the police don't seem to mind if people aren't social distancing. They're not breaking those up. And the same goes with the Liverpool football club, where they had a big celebration yesterday after winning some game. So what we're seeing is, it almost seems as if the police, if it's a small enough gathering, the police will weigh in and break it up. And actually, you know, I mean, there's the basic point, Martin, is if the police do weigh in a situation like that, it's likely to make things worse.
Well, that's presumably what the operational policing decisions are based on. That some certain circumstances, if you're going to charge in there and so what happened in Bristol the other week, the police could have defended the statue with baton charges and so on, but that would have been a poor decision. And I understand that what's happened is they've now identified various people who they think were involved, and they'll pass that to the Crown Prosecution Service and they can have a look at it. But what's beginning to happen, and I can sense it around Bristol where I live in Easton and so on, is that people are just getting fed up with being locked down, and the government seems to have said that it's all over. And it's very hard to get back to the basic simple messages which we were working with originally. Now nobody really knows what the rules are. And when people don't know what the rules are, then they just do their own thing, don't they? And of course, once you've lost control of it like that, you've lost control of it. And
yeah,
we will see what
the figures are. Certainly not going through the roof, are they? Of the virus, maybe it is the right time to do this.
We're basically at the same position we were just before the lockdown. We've got back to that level, but the danger is, of course, that if everybody goes back to doing what they did before, we're just going to go shooting back up again. And of course, there'll have to be then a second lockdown in the economy.
Well, what they're doing, I mean, I think you're exaggerating this. What they're doing is they're opening things up bit by bit, aren't they?
Well, they're saying that's what they want to do, but there's no rationality in it. They're opening certain things and not other things. They're making it up as they go along. They want the economy to work. But, you know, in New Zealand, they can open up the whole economy. They can do it because they crushed the virus. We haven't got anywhere near that.
Okay, so, well, let's have a look at Well, listen anyway to Paul Manning now talking about, again, my favourite topic is Martin Bormann. There are a couple of interviews here with him from the 1990s on the Dave Emery show on Spitfire List. The first one of the two sounds as if he might have had a drink or two, but this is much more coherent here. This is an incredible story, really, of a book written by his father, who was one of the top CBS journalists in the Second World War, reporting on Germany and the war in Europe. For American listeners, they would have known him, heard his voice on the radio, many of them. And he was a really superb journalist. And his son, Peter Manning, is the person who's being interviewed here by Dave Emery from Spitfire List. And it's also his brother. It was worth reminding everybody about the horrific bloody situation with his brother, where his brother Jerry was shot dead in cold blood in New York a little while after the book was published, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. And I think that's probably the best recommendation you can almost ever have for reading a book. It's a fascinating book about economic history of the Third Reich and their economic warfare tactics, which were then taken up. And much of what's going on in the world today could well be because of the investments made with all this Nazi money from after the Second World War. Also, the publisher, Lyle Stewart, in 1981 of the book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, had both of his legs broken. And we'll be hearing maybe a bit about that, but mainly to do with who Paul Manning was and the world in which he was working. So let's have a listen to his son, Peter Manning, now speaking to Dave Emery.
At the time, the journalists were real journalists. They weren't celebrity announcers. And at the end of World War II, the news team got replaced by people who were simply announcers who would toe the corporate line. So the real journalists, with a few exceptions, were just left out.
And what your father came across in studying the Nazi flight capital was the fact, incredible to the uninitiated and disturbing to those who know, that the Third Reich did not disappear but went underground.
Yeah, I think he didn't realize how big the story was. He was just a journalist. He found a few things out at the end of the war. You know, what happened to Martin Bormann was one of the stories he was chasing down. And he thought some Nazis got away and took money with them, ran off to South America, and he chased down this story. Then he came back to the U.S., had a career, and he stumbled back into this story in the 1960s. I know he was 100% of his time was put into this in the late 60s and going into the early 70s. This was sort of a six-day-a-week project. He went to Europe a few times. What he wanted to do is actually interview Martin Bormann. So he was in contact with the Martin Bormann people in Europe and down in South America. And actually in 1972 or 73, I'm not sure when, there was a very elaborate plan that three photographers from CBS would go down to South America with my father, and he would interview Martin Bormann live, and it would be the anchor up in New York would be Walter Cronkite. That plan fell through, and the reason given is that the younger people in the Bormann organization did not want to rock the boat or make themselves known, whereas the older members wanted to proudly tell their history of how they helped an emerging new West Germany and how they also helped to fight communism.
That great, albeit unpalatable truth to many, which is that the Reich did survive and went in an underground fashion.
Yeah, definitely. It's a worldwide organization, but it looked to be purely commercial. What you say about a Fourth Reich coming around, I've been thinking about this for years, and yeah, I agree. I think it's not just commercial, it's philosophical, and they do want to emerge sometime in the near future.
Just wanted to read into the record the remarkable correspondence that took place between your father and Heinrich Müller. Heinrich Müller, by the way, was the head of the Gestapo in World War II and then went underground with the Bormann organization and became its director of security. And it was an absolutely feared individual. Anybody who crossed the Bormann group, if Müller decided, they died. And that was simply the way it went. Reading now from your father's book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. During years of research for this book, I have become aware of Heinrich Müller and his security force, which provides protection for the leadership in Latin America and wherever else they may travel to Europe and to the United States to check on investments and profits. Through intermediaries, I have attempted unceasingly to penetrate to the central core of the organization in South America, but have been denied access. At the last meeting that I know about, it was voted, quote, Herr Manning's writing would focus undue attention on our activities, and his request must once again be denied, unquote. The elderly leaders, including Reichsminister Bormann, who is now 80, wanted me on the scene to write of their side of the story, above all his story of one of the most amazing and successful financial and industrial cloaking actions in history, of which he is justifiably proud. I had sent word to Bormann that the true story, his first-hand account, should become a matter of historical record, and stated that I would be agreeable to writing it if I could tell his true story, warts and all. Back came the word, quote, You are a free-world journalist and can write as you think best. We, too, are interested only in truth, unquote. They agreed to my request to bring along a three-man camera crew from CBS News to film my conversations with Martin Bormann, and even approved my wish for at least a personal thumbprint of the former Reichsleiter and party minister, which would be positive proof of his identity. At the organization's request, I sent the background, names, photos, and credentials of this particular CBS cameramen, Lawrence Walter Pierce, Richard Henry Perez, and Odin Lester Kitzmiller, an award-winning camera crew which got the exclusive film coverage of the attempted assassination of Governor George Wallace when he was running for president. I'm sorry to say that the younger leaders, the ones in virtual command, voted no.
That's right. Since he got shot down after many attempts at trying to interview Bormann and get an interview, he decided to write a book and have it published in the West, in New York. And he got the book, he shopped it around, it got warmly accepted at the editorial level at Doubleday and Dutton. But once it got past the first editor, they come back a week or two later and say, now we can't do anything here. Well, he got a maverick publisher, Lyle Stewart, at the time to pick up the book, and it was published in a very conventional way, well edited and put out. So all this information came out during the early to mid-70s. He kept rewriting it, got it finally published around 1980-81, and got rave reviews all over the country, Atlantic City, Des Moines, Chicago. He was on a talk show, a live news talk show in Chicago, just rave reviews. However, there was absolute dead silence in the New York Times and the New York Book Review community. They would not review the book. They wouldn't mention it. They wouldn't pan it. They wouldn't say it was goofy. They just didn't mention it. So down in Washington also there was silence. There was no book reviews coming out of the town of Washington, D.C. And then also in Los Angeles, what with the movie making and the TV industry out there, there was a book review, but it really said a lot of bad things about the theory. If you read the book, my father uses a lot of facts and he builds a case and he states his theory.
Mm-hmm.
And you could believe it or not, but the facts are there. My father was blacklisted. They just wouldn't take him seriously.
Something that's interesting is the contrast between the apparent attitude of the Bormann group themselves. At least the older guard were interested in getting the story out. Reading from the introduction to your father's book, oddly, I encountered less resistance from Martin Bormann and his aging peers than I did from the cover-up groups in West Germany, Paris, London, Washington, and Wall Street. Bormann knows he is mortal, as are his cronies who have turned over the day-to-day direction of the Bormann organization to a younger leadership. The old guard want the story told, and the only point of friction is whether it should be before or after Fuhrer Bormann's demise. And he also writes earlier in the introduction, The closer I got to the truth, the more quiet attention I received from the forces surrounding and protecting Martin Bormann, and also from those who had a direct interest in halting my investigation. Over the period of years it took to research this book, I was the object of diligent observations by squads of Gestapo agents dispatched from South America by General Gestapo Mueller, who directs all security matters for Martin Bormann, Nazi in exile, and his organization, the most remarkable business group anywhere in the secret world of today. Mueller's interest in me, an American journalist, confirmed the truth of my many interviews and my ongoing investigation. Bormann is alive, they don't want waves, so they have been willing to expend immense time and money in tracking me and my progress.
Yeah, well, he spent a lot of his time for many years, and it didn't pan out, didn't make a profit, didn't make any money, so the family didn't have too much money.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also very emotionally draining because the people he had counted on to publicize this, he was treated like he was a lunatic. He had friends in the New York Times, old war correspondent buddies, who were very enthusiastic about the book when it was just about to be coming out and said, yeah, this is great, Paul. This is a big score for you. This is a coup. We definitely got to write something about this. But then they get back a week or so later and say, look, Paul, I'm sorry, I can't help you. I don't want to lose my pension.
Mm-hmm.
And these were, number one A writers for the New York Times, very respected, very well-known journalists. Also in the television world, he had friends who used to be correspondents who at first were going to help him and then just turned their back on him completely. He was kind of a simple guy. He's from the 20s and 30s. His generation were things were black and white. He was a patriot. He was a journalist. But it was a very complicated world after TV came on the scene, and he just didn't get how complex the world was. He was just kept chasing this story, came out with his book. I don't know if it's still available, but he put about two decades of his life into it.
And came up with a very remarkable work. And if the truth about political reality is ever to be understood, people are going to have to come to terms with your father's remarkable book. Last week, Peter, you also mentioned the visible harassment that your father and your family received from the surveillance, from the surveillance, the agents of surveillance or the team.
Yeah, well, I was in high school at the time. Then I in 1969, graduated, got into college down at NYU. So I was living at home again. But, they'd always be telling stories about how someone would be following my mother. And these were not muggers or anything. These were just mysterious people who would be following and looking. Sometimes they'd, a couple of guys once in New York City outside Saks Fifth Avenue kind of leaned up on her in a crowd and pulled the papers out of her hand and walked away. These are guys in gray business suits. Just weird things happening. The phone was bugged. He was being, watched by several people who wanted to know if he was onto something or who he was working for, if any, or if he was just a propagandist for some organization. But he was working absolutely alone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And
no one supported him. No one gave him any money to fund. It was totally his own doing.
You mentioned last week, too, that your brother Jerry's mysterious murder was believed by your father to have been in retribution for the book. Is that correct?
That's right.
And again, my condolences for his murder. No assailant ever found, nothing taken, just a...
No, never. It was just strange circumstances. Of course, New York City in 1993, that was their biggest year for homicides. It was over 1,000 homicides.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a dangerous city. I grew up there, lived there for many years. But it was middle of the afternoon on February on the top floor of a six-floor walk-up. He wasn't rich. He wasn't involved with bad guys or drugs or anything. He was just shot.
Nothing taken?
Nothing. Well, he didn't have anything. He was a painter, like Edward Hopper. There was no reason to mug him or steal from him.
And also, we should stress, there was no quarrel. In other words, he wasn't engaged in an argument.
No, it was just bang, 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 according to the neighbor. He went down to a store downstairs to get some stuff for an elderly resident of the floor,
mm-hmm,
who couldn't walk up and down six floors. So he ran up, as was his custom, ran up to six floors, went into his apartment, came out to deliver the food to the elderly lady, and it was bang, 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 and that was it. I mean, it didn't appear to be any motive. Plus, he was a real kind guy. He wasn't involved with friction or fighting or anything. He was just a real sweet person.
Mm-hmm. And again, for those who might express skepticism that this would be connected with your father's work, I've seen things like that happen to people I know, including people who've had their children retaliated against for what they've done. That's not an uncommon scenario. And again, your father was of the conviction that this was in retaliation for the book.
Yeah, I mean, he went through World War II, and there was a lot of fighting. There was a lot of spy stories told. This was a reality. This is how things were done.
Mm-hmm.
He had a lot of friends who worked for the Secret Service in Britain and the spy operations during World War II who were American, because the journalists, it was all part of an effort, and it was typical for a journalist to be part of the military effort.
Mm-hmm.
There were censors then, but they all worked together. And he had a lot of friends from the war who eventually got into intelligence after World War II. He had a lot of sources.
Mm-hmm. Your father had received information or had done research indicating that the Borman Group had infiltrated the CIA, but the CIA did not know that.
Yeah, well, it's like it's a vaccine, but maybe it's tainted. We took German scientists into our space program. We needed them.
Right.
We utilized them. All of a sudden, after World War II, we're fighting the communists, so we need these talented Nazis to help us fight.
Mm-hmm.
So they came into our American intelligence community. They controlled it.
Right.
Even though most of the intelligence community were all patriots and hardworking and on the right track, there was a little inner circle that had their own different agenda. You take a look at American behavior in the world after World War II. It's coming out now that our intelligence community did a lot of really bad things.
Mm-hmm.
Coup d'etat against democratically elected communist leaders.
All kinds of people.
All over the place. Bringing guns into one area, taking drugs out, selling drugs here, taking the money to buy more guns to fund more wars.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of nasty things that ostensibly were done by the U.S., not in U.S. character.
Right.
We went to war in World War II to free the world and to oppress tyranny. And all of a sudden, after World War II, the U.S. character is doing all these really evil things. It doesn't add up. Maybe it was a Nazi influence that caused all this.
So that's Peter Manning there, the son of Paul Manning, the author of Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. Pretty articulate guy, I think you'd agree, Martin.
Yeah, and I've read the book, and it's well worth reading. And, I think what he said at the end there about the Nazis getting a big influence inside the U.S. intelligence community, that's certainly true. But I think, basically, the U.S. has always had a fairly reactionary attitude, but homegrown. You know, they were carrying out war crimes in the Philippines in the 1890s without any German help.
But, I mean, surely it was just sort of around the time before World War II in the 1930s, there was a real tussle for control of the country with the fascists, between the fascists represented by Bush's, Prescott Bush, people like this, trying to basically take over the country. And the idea that suddenly a load of Nazis are going to turn up in the intelligence service, the OSS, then the CIA, it's almost like a pact is done with the devil to clinch the deal.
Yeah, but I mean, don't forget they had links going with the Nazi Party going back before the war. Basically the West has got this fascist canker at the heart of it, and it's related. You know, all sorts of nasty stuff goes on, as people who listen to our show will realise.
I think one of the things that you said there, which entertains me, is the idea that the journalists have been removed and replaced by celebrity announcers.
Well, you know what's going on, Tony. I mean, the serious investigative journalism is not being carried out by the mainstream anymore. It's basically infotainment and psychological warfare. A lot of what media people consume is basically non. It doesn't tell you anything. It's just keeps your mind busy. You know, we were just mentioning earlier how Wikipedia works, and there's people working around the clock.
Okay, well, let's sum up by talking about the whole Salisbury business, right? Because this is, I think, a good example of something that should be being talked about, but is just being talk rubbish. There is the alternative version of what we've been fed of these Russians coming over here on the Saker, which I put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk last week. Basically, that Skripal was planning on doing a runner back to Russia with support of the FSB, spilling the beans on the faked up Trump Putin dossier. Yeah, so this is the Steele dossier, and we know that Steele was involved very closely with Skripal. So MI6 organised this whole so-called incident in order to, first of all, disappear Skripal and Julia, who were part of the escape plan, and B, inflict a monstrous slander on Russia and Putin. I think, you know, that version of events holds more water than the incredible official conspiracy theory.
Well, I tend to agree with you, obviously. But you'd be, as Craig Murray, the former ambassador, has pointed out, the average punter who doesn't pay too much attention, presumes they know what happened there, and it's evil Rasputin, the poisoner, because basically they're relying on people's memories of things like James Bond and all the rest of it, and that their actual understanding of what Russian politics is about, because it's quite complicated, Russian politics, not straightforward at all, that most people haven't got the wit or the inclination to look any deeper than the...
Okay, so what would have happened if Skripal had managed to go back to Russia to spill the beans on the faked-up Trump-Putin dossier?
Well, it could have led to the situation where Trump won the election anyway. But don't forget...
Well, Martin, what I'm trying to get at here is surely this would make Britain look really bad, wouldn't it?
Well, the MI6 are clearly aligned... The British establishment are clearly aligned with the war faction and the Democrat Party. They're not very happy with Trump. And that's what, you know, they're basically sticking their finger in. I mean, they're talking about the Russians fiddling US elections. It's the British and the Israelis who are fiddling US elections.
So do all these lies and propaganda in the long term, do they work?
Well, obviously they do. That's why they do it. I mean, it's all very well us talking to the choir here on our radio show and our well-informed audience, but for most people, they basically accept the rather stilted worldview that they're being fed. I mean, there's going to be a vote very shortly in Russia to change the constitution to allow Putin or anybody to have continuous, you know, they can be elected any number of times. And it looks as if they're going to get about 60% of the vote in favour of it. The Communist Party are opposed. They're the main opposition party in China, not in China, in Russia, but they haven't got enough support. But this is presented in, I was looking at The Guardian earlier, it's presented as Russia's fake vote. Well, what's fake about a vote where 60% of people
vote? Well, it's a fake vote because they don't like the outcome, and that seems to be happening all the time now.
That just tells you everything you need to know, doesn't it, about what people's vision... Like
the Brexit referendum.
Well, I mean, it's the Brexit referendum has happened, but it was this is going to be much, you know, this is going to be much more emphatic than that's a rather close result.
It's actually what they're doing is quite interesting there, isn't it? It's basically a sort of mixture between a monarchy and a democracy. So someone can stay in power so long as they're regularly re-elected, they can carry on. I mean,
that's the position in Britain. Obviously, what you've got in the US is you can only have two terms as a president. And that's sort of the situation in Russia as well as it is in France. But I think what Putin is doing, what he said is, look, I'm not necessarily going to carry on, but we've got to have a situation where we can carry on functioning. So that, because what will happen if we don't is round about now, I'm going to be running out of my presidential term and everybody's going to be rowing and arguing about who's going to replace me. Whereas if we do this, I mean, and don't forget, this was what Hugo Chavez did in Venezuela. You don't have, if people want to carry on voting for the same person, why not? There's no, what's the rule that says you've got to have somebody new and there's got to be two parties in power or whatever? It depends what people want, doesn't it? I mean, you know, the Mexican PRI, the Mexican Institutional Revolutionary Party, they're in power for decades. And the Liberal Democratic Party in Japan has been in power for decades. It's not entirely a democratic setup, but if that's what people want and that's what they voted for, why should anybody else outside Russia decide?
So why is this a threat, and why do the Guardian not like it? So MI6 don't like it.
Well, I mean, it plays to the idea that Putin wants he basically just wants to hang on forever and keep power. I don't think he does want to hang on forever. I can imagine he probably wants to retire, but the problem is that the situation in Russia is so dire in terms of the conflicts with the West, the war in Syria and Ukraine, the potential collapse of the economy, sanctions. He just doesn't feel that anybody else would be able to manage and that's generally the view of the Russian population. They look at their leaders and think, well, actually, of all the people that might be running things, he's the one that's most likely to be able to manage to do it. And he's got a lot of support because he's been doing it for a long time.
He's far more popular than the leaders in the West.
Well, he is. And that's then presented in the West as this can't be right, because politicians in the West fight like cats in a sack, and one's in, one's out, you know, nobody gets to be in charge for very long. And in Russia, they've basically decided, don't forget, they went through a period of complete turmoil in the Yeltsin era, and people are rather grateful that they've now got a steady hand on the tiller of somebody who seems to know what they're doing.
Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guests. That is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. You'll find this show's podcast story links, comment page, and contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend, Sunday evening at 7 with Danny Lopsch. Well worth a listen. BCFM boss Pat Hart did say our sister show Dialect would be on BCFM every Monday at 10 p.m, but so far it hasn't been. The latest is this show might be back in November, but don't hold your breath, dear listeners. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at the old time of 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.